With Trump's paramilitary goon squads assaulting peaceful protesters in American cities, things are looking pretty grim for democracy in America. But Joe McCarthy biographer Larry Tai thinks we will turn this around.
So I come out an ultimate optimist. I come out feeling partly when the American public pushes back the way they are pushing back now, but also when we see enough of bullies, we are good ultimately in recognizing and standing up to them. And I think the lesson of Joe McCarthy and of demagogues generally in America is a positive one, that Americans ultimately don't like bullies.
We'll talk with Larry Tai about his acclaimed new book, Demagogue: The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Then, a novel that asks the question, how do we balance the risks of political protest with the consequences, especially when those protests turn violent?
Well, I think most of the violence at demonstrations has always been perpetrated by the police against the demonstrators. The overwhelming majority of the violence has gone in that direction. But, you know, political protests can have an element of violence. What I do want readers to understand through the story and through the characters is how incredibly important it is to stand up for what you believe in, no matter how you do it, no matter if you're in the street throwing things, or much more likely in the street holding a sign and protesting, but that each of these choices can have real consequences and can have some pretty significant risks.
That's Ellen Mirapol. We talk with her about her new novel, Her Sister's Tattoo. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. In the long history of American demagogues, never has one man caused so much damage in such a short time as Senator Joe McCarthy, at least until the current occupant of the White House, Donald Trump. From 1950 to 1954, McCarthy destroyed many careers and even entire lives, whipping the nation into a frenzy of paranoia, accusation, loyalty oaths, and terror. Now, Larry Tai, best-selling biographer of Bobby Kennedy and Satchel Paige, has been able to take an exclusive look at the senator's records to tell the full story of Joe McCarthy. In Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, Tai draws a direct line from the Wisconsin senator to Trump, showing how Trump not only uses the McCarthy playbook, but also how McCarthy's right-hand man Roy Cohn became Donald Trump's mentor. In his story lie salient messages for our current times. Well, Larry Tai, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be on with you.
Your first sentence in this book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, is, this is a book about America's love affair with bullies. So explain that sentence. It's clearly more than about just Joe McCarthy.
It is. There have been, from the beginning of the American story, there have been demagogues. There have been bullies ranging from Huey Long and Theodore Bilbo, a crazy senator from the South, who predated McCarthy, up through George Wallace and David Duke and lots of ones who came after. And so a long line of the uniquely American strain of bullies or demagogues. And what makes Joe McCarthy stand out is that he was the archetype. He was the one who learned from all the ones who came before him, and he was the model for everyone who came after.
Yeah, and also what's really remarkable, and I was surprised at this, is you gained access to his personal and professional papers, his medical records, transcripts of closed congressional hearings. They've all been under lock and key for 70 years. Why?
So they've been under lock and key because when McCarthy's widow donated all of his personal and professional papers to Marquette University, McCarthy's alma mater, she said those would become public only when our infant daughter either dies or says they will become public. And for 60 years, there has been no access granted to anybody. And for whatever reason, whether it was the alignment of the stars or luck or my being persistent, the family said, you can look at them. But they said it in an unusual way, which is, you can have access to them, and as soon as you stop looking at them, they go back under lock and key. And so it was a wonderful opportunity to go and see all these papers that had been sitting there, pile after pile of papers on everything from his love letters to his office records to papers that helped make him into a more three-dimensional human figure. Those were wonderful if that was all that there was. It turned out that not long before I had started on my research, all of the 9,000 pages of transcripts of his closed-door hearings that the Senate had decided would stay under lock and key, that those had been opened up. And while journalists had had a look at those, nobody had really gone deep and read the 9,000 pages, and they show Joe McCarthy unhinged at a time when he thought that he could say anything or do anything he wanted and that the records would never become public. Now we have a look at them. And the last pile of papers was his medical records, which the Bethesda Naval Hospital, which is where he had been treated for things from the time he took over as a senator until the day he died, all of those files turned up on my doorstep one day, and I had totally given up on ever seeing those, and those gave a different sense of what he had been suffering during the time he was a senator and gave a very different sense of what he died from. And it turned out he didn't die from what the coroner and what the press reported. So if I couldn't write a good book with access to all that material, then shame on me.
Well, take us out of suspense. What did he die of?
So he died of, in simple terms, drinking too much. He died of the DTs. He died of all the complications from alcohol poisoning. Everybody knew that he was somebody who had a couple drinks every day at lunch, and that as he aged and as he came off of his condemnation by his fellow senators, that he was going downhill. But the coroner and the newspapers reported that he died of acute hepatitis, and that may have been one of the many complications he was suffering. But I sat down with a group that included the former dean of the Harvard Medical School and the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. I didn't want to trust my read of what he died of, and they agreed that it was all complications of his alcoholism. And it was incredibly sad, because for the last days of his life, he had an aide, a military aide, sitting next to him at Bethesda Naval Hospital, taking down everything that was happening to him and every one of his utterances, and they became increasingly incomprehensible. And in a way that we never have, it was like I was sitting there with him the last days of his life and watching him go downhill in a way that was tragic.
Wow. Now, you also spoke to friends and colleagues, as well as his victims. How forthcoming were they?
So people were incredibly forthcoming. His victims were forthcoming because they wanted to tell their story. They wanted to basically say, this wasn't just getting dragged in front of an angry senator and tolerating his tirades for an hour or two. The kind of victims that I was talking to are people whose lives were disrupted. Many of them lost their jobs. Some of them watched a spouse or somebody close to them commit suicide. It was the kind of thing that I think is really instructive for today, to understand what it's like to be a victim of a demagogue and to be targeted by them. And that was an effect that in many cases lasted for the rest of their lives.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Larry Tye about his biography of Senator Joe McCarthy. It's called Demagogue. My great aunt and her husband, they were both psychologists at Bellevue Hospital and well-known psychologists. He became the chief of the psychiatry unit there after McCarthyism. But during McCarthyism, they were targeted. And I never got the whole story, but yeah, this reached pretty far into a lot of families.
It did. And sometimes I could talk to people who were actually the victims themselves. More often I was talking to their children or their grandchildren, because this happened in the 1950s, and they wanted to tell this story. And they often had memoirs that their relatives had left behind, which was their moment-by-moment unpublished rendition of what it was like to have to go before Joe McCarthy. And it was extraordinary. There was one guy in particular, a guy named Reed Harris, who was a senior official at the Voice of America, and he was targeted by McCarthy for things that he had done dating back to his days in college and his flirtations with the left and with communism back then. But to McCarthy, those were reasons to pull him through hell 20, 30 years later when he was working for the government. Reed Harris left behind a memoir. And he also, Reed Harris's son, explained how Reed's wife and this guy's, Donald Harris's, mother had taken her own life when it just became too much to tolerate all that had happened, their family being pulled apart because of Senator Joe McCarthy.
So now I'm going to skip over, because there's so much in this wonderful book, I'm going to mostly skip over his early life. But if there's one thing you would want us to know about it, what would that be?
So it would be that it was something counterintuitive to me. One of the things McCarthy left in his papers at Marquette University was his diary of his days in the South Pacific fighting for the Marines. And reporters and critics of McCarthy over the years assumed that this guy, because he had embellished so much in his life and because he had embellished his charges against the people he was targeting, they assumed that he was lying in saying that he was a hero during World War II who deserved the stack of medals that the Marines gave him. And they said they took his calling himself Tail Gunner Joe. They took that to be a huge lie, and it became a caricature of the guy. And CBS once did a documentary on him called Tail Gunner Joe, making fun of the fact that this guy, who was really a land-based intelligence agent, had ever put his life at risk by flying as a tail gunner. Well, his diaries and letters from his fellow Marines on that South Pacific island show that, in fact, while his official assignment was as a land-based intelligence officer, he did, in fact, volunteer for missions where he flew as a tail gunner. He came under enemy fire, and he deserved every one of the medals that he earned. And to me, that showed two things. One is the story wasn't the simple black and white story of who Joe McCarthy was. But the other lesson that I think is instructive is, if you embellish and lie enough, we're going to think everything you say is a lie.
Yeah, he was really the master of the big lie. One of the earliest ones, talk about the massacre that happened during World War II in a town in Belgium, and how after the war, he defended the SS. There had been a group of SS prisoners, and he excoriated the American GIs. Is that an example of the big lie?
So it's an example of him going in a direction that is totally inexplicable, and being willing, as part of going in that direction, to tell the little lie and the big lie. This was known as the Malmedy Massacre. And as you say, it was near the town of Malmedy in Belgium. And it was one of the worst massacres perpetrated by Nazi SS troops during World War II. They took a bunch of American soldiers who were raising a white flag and killed them. And they murdered them by hitting them in the head with rifle butts, and by going up in close range and firing a bullet into their heads. Horrible massacre, big war crimes trial. Everybody is sentenced to death, and I think rightfully sentenced to death. And all of a sudden, there are peace activists and there are Nazi apologists who came along and questioned the verdicts and said, geez, the troops, the Nazi SS perpetrators were subject to torture, their confessions weren't real, and they might have been innocent. Well, in fact, there were some violations, but they weren't innocent, their confessions were real, and the only person in the U.S. Senate who stood up and defended these guys was a senator that nobody knew named Joe McCarthy. And I think what he was doing was looking for an issue that would make him stand out in a Senate, an early part of his Senate career that was entirely unexceptional. He looked like he might be ready for defeat in his next election, and he knew that there was an enormous German-American population in the state of Wisconsin where he was going to be up for re-election. And I think he was playing to German-Americans who I think wouldn't have wanted to defend these Nazi perpetrators. And he was taking small things that looked like irregularities in the proceeding and blowing them entirely out of proportion. And that's not just my conclusion. It was the conclusion of Senate investigators, and it was the conclusion of a great book that recently came out on the Malmedy massacre, saying the verdicts were really just and Joe McCarthy was way off base.
So he comes out of that not exactly looking like a rose. It didn't help his career. So he pivoted, and in 1950, at the Lincoln Day Dinner in Wheeling, West Virginia, McCarthy delivered his famous Commies in the State Department speech that launched his campaign and gave birth to McCarthyism. So talk a little bit about that. You say he began as a gamesman and a carpetbagger, but he ended up as a true believer and a missionary. So talk about that speech and that process.
He went to Wheeling, West Virginia that night with two speeches in his briefcase. One was on a topic he knew something about, which was U.S. housing policy. And it was something that he initially took up as a great cause on behalf of his fellow, the veterans of World War II, that they deserved housing and that we should go on a massive housing building program. That was the snoozer of a speech, and he decided at the last minute to keep that in his briefcase. And instead, he took out a second speech, which was on a topic that he knew next to nothing about, which was on communists, alleged communists in the military. But he was enough of an opportunist that he realized that that was the barn burner of a speech that he ought to give. And he was enough of a guy who could sniff out a big issue that he realized rather than making generic charges about the Cold War, and we got to take the Cold War seriously, he knew if he could name traitors, put names to the notion that there were traitors in our own government, that he could generate headlines. So he waves around a speech that he wouldn't show anybody, saying, I've got in my hand the names of 200 subversives at the State Department, and I call on the American government to get rid of these people. And journalists around the country thought that was brilliant, and he became front page news, which was what he wanted to be.
I'm going to get back to that point in a moment, but you say that the dictionary definitions of demagogue and McCarthyism, and by the way, he didn't like the term McCarthyism, are strikingly similar. In what way are those definitions similar, demagogue and McCarthyism?
So they both are people who play to public fears, and in McCarthy's case, it was the fear of communism, which was a real fear back then, and look for easy scapegoats, which in McCarthy's case was the alleged saboteurs and spies in our own U.S. government. And it plays to this sense, this great Greek drama, which is where the word demagogue came from, of the popular imagination, and it spins that imagination in ways that are dangerous, I think, to the country, because it gives us simple answers. It gives us scapegoats rather than solutions, and it plays to populism by lighting a fire behind any real sense of public paranoia.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Larry Tai about his acclaimed new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. You know, I'm going to press you on that word populism because actually it has a very different meaning, I think, in American history. The populist movement, which was really a movement of unity between black and white farmers, which was really fighting for economic justice. So I kind of resent that so many people use the word populism to talk about demagogues.
Yes. So I think you're exactly right. I think populism can either be said. I want to actually stick with McCarthy in the state of Wisconsin and show you an instance of good populism and of bad populism. And in my mind, good populism was the guy he beat for the U.S. Senate and that man's father. And that was a man named Robert La Follette, a founder of the Progressive Party. His father was the ultimate progressive populist, uniting people who farmers and activists for lots of progressive causes that I think were uniting people to try to build a movement that was a constructive movement. McCarthy came along and understood that Wisconsin had bought into that kind of La Follette populism, and he played it for all the wrong reasons, which was playing to resentments and trying to divide people rather than unite them behind a cause. And my last book was about one of the greatest, I think, American populists of all times, who could have been, I think, one of our greatest presidents, Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was a protege of Joe McCarthy's in McCarthy's days as a senator. His first employer and his mentor, Bobby's mentor, was Joe McCarthy. And he took McCarthy's fiery populism and I think tried to make it a unifying force rather than a divisive one that his mentor had done.
That's a great point. Yeah. So you really draw a line, a direct line, between Joe McCarthy and Donald Trump. So what are some of the ways that Joe McCarthy and Trump operate from the same playbook? And talk about the actual direct lines between them.
So the playbook is one that I think Trump has borrowed in a way that he is perhaps McCarthy's most apt student. And that I want to give you just a few instances of that. I think that both McCarthy and Trump are looking for scapegoats to explain things that are legitimate woes in America. And with McCarthy, it was blaming communists lurking behind every pillar in the State Department. With Donald Trump, it's blaming immigrants and outsiders for the problems of America, whether it is pointing a finger at China when it comes to the pandemic, or pointing a finger at migrants for Americans being out of work or having whatever woes they suffer. I think that both Trump and McCarthy, every time they aim a bomb at their enemy and their charge is exposed as hollow, they lob a fresh bombshell. Every time they're attacked, they aim a wrecking ball at their assailant. If the news is bad, they blame the newsmen. And I think it's not accidental that Trump has been such an apt student of McCarthy, because it turns out that a guy named Roy Cohn, who was Joe McCarthy's protege in the 1950s, in the 1970s and 80s, was Donald Trump's tutor. And Roy Cohn was the flesh and blood through line, taking all of what worked so well for Joe McCarthy in his rise to power and helping it work for Donald Trump in his rise to power.
Yeah, give us some concrete examples of the messages and strategies that Roy Cohn passed from McCarthy to Trump.
So one of the best was to, when an enemy attacks you, never wait for a rational, logical response to develop in terms of going back against that enemy. It's to kick him as hard and in exactly the place that's going to hurt the most. It's to take and turn your enemy's charges against you into charges back against them. So in the news of today, when somebody like John Bolton is attacking Donald Trump, we know precisely the kinds of tweets. We can anticipate what those tweets are going to be the next day, and they're going to be going after Bolton, not in terms of the charges that he leveled, but in terms of his own credibility and saying things about him that are kicking him twice as hard as Bolton kicked Trump. And that was classic Roy Cohn, classic Joe McCarthy. It was, if you get in my crosshairs, watch out, because I'm a bulldozer and I'm going to run you over.
What are some of the best ways candidates and voters, for that matter, can push back against those kinds of attacks?
All I can do is tell you, I can't predict what's going to happen with Trump, but I can tell you what happened to McCarthy as a potential predictor of where things could head. Joe McCarthy was a bully who took on the State Department, he took on the Voice of America, he took on the government printing office, and those were all easy targets. And he had a field day with them. He ended up picking as his ultimate target the U.S. Army. When he was charging in 1954 and 1953, the end of 53 and 54, that the Army was infiltrated with spies. And that was something. He picked an institution that was the mighty American fighting machine, and that was an institution that proved too big to bully. That was when the Army brass stood up against McCarthy, when Dwight Eisenhower, our former World War II great commander, finally stood up against Joe McCarthy, and when the American public ended up turning on Joe McCarthy in the famous Army-McCarthy hearings. And I think Donald Trump has lately been doing something similar. He has seen the military as a force that he could call out to put down peaceful and less peaceful street protests. He saw the military brass, former Joint Chiefs of Staff heads, even his current Secretary of Defense, stand up and say, no, you're abusing the sacred institution of the U.S. military. And I think that we are seeing that there are some things that a bully gets pushback on, an effective pushback, and there's a certain critical mass. When one head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff stands up and says this is wrong, when predecessors do it, the current Joint Chief stood up recently and said, I was misused, I was dragged into a political battle, I made a mistake. And I think that we saw it in the Senate back then, when a few senators stood up, like Margaret Chase Smith, the senator from Maine, and said Joe McCarthy was wrong. Very few of her colleagues stood up with her. But once it reached a critical mass, and once he started getting real pushback, more and more people suddenly developed a backbone. And I think we may be seeing that happening now. History will tell us, but there is hope that demagogues ultimately, always in American history, have done themselves in.
Bernie Sanders, during his campaign, often said that real change only comes when millions of people go into the streets. And we're really seeing an unprecedented movement of protests that is fully diverse. After 4 years of the real growth and rise of the right wing and of racism and white supremacy, given the lens, the amazing lens that you were able to train on Joe McCarthy, what lessons do you draw from that movement of protest as a check on the power of demagogues like Donald Trump and Joe McCarthy?
So I come out an ultimate optimist. I come out feeling, partly when the American public pushes back the way they are pushing back now, but also when we see enough of bullies, we are good ultimately in recognizing and standing up to them. And I think the lesson of Joe McCarthy and of demagogues generally in America is a positive one, that Americans ultimately don't like bullies. Every demagogue in American history has managed, generally sooner rather than later, to do themselves in. So it's got a good news ending.
Well, the book is absolutely terrific. Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry Tye, it's just been great to talk with you. I mean, there's so much we could have gone into, but our readers will just have to read your book to get them.
So you're very generous, and I appreciate being with you again today.
Larry Tai is the author of 8 books. Go to writersvoice.net for links to our interview with him about his biography of Bobby Kennedy and to read an excerpt from Demagogue. Next up, a novel about political activism and the choices people make. But first, let's listen to Joe McCarthy deliver some remarks about hunting communists.
Now, some of my good friends, good sincere people too, have said to me, McCarthy, during the time you've been waging this attempt to uncover treason in government, so many of them said, oh, we like what you're trying to do. I'm not going to read all this. We like what you are trying to do, but, oh, we don't like your methods. I've heard that over and over and over like a broken phonograph record. You know, when any of my friends say that, I always say, well, the water is good, come on in. If you want to dig any out, if you've got some delicate method of doing it, if you can fight communists with a lace handkerchief, it's okay with me. And I often think of the days I spent back on the farm as a small boy. I had 3 brothers. My mother used to raise chickens to help pay the grocery bills and get her Christmas money. And one of the jobs I had with my 3 brothers was to go down into the swamps and dig out the skunks that used to come up and kill our baby chickens. You know, you earn early and learn early in life. You'll learn early in life that you don't go skunk hunting with striped trousers, a silk handkerchief, and a top hat. You just can't do it. And you also learn that the more successful your skunk hunting expedition, the less welcome you may be sitting next to your neighbors in church the following Sunday. I may say that we're engaged now in, as you well know, in digging out a much smellier breed of animal than I dug out back on the farm. And I may say I don't much give a tinker's damn what anyone says about methods. I don't much care about the advice to stop. This job must continue, my good friends. It will continue, as far as I'm concerned, as long as I am in the United States Senate, regardless of whether we hurt Democrats or Republicans or anyone else.
Joe McCarthy talking to the Middleton Republican Club of Leonardo, New Jersey in 1953. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter, all free, at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations, web-only interviews, and extended interviews. Ellen Meerpol has carved out a very special genre for her fiction writing. She writes novels about leftist political protest and the establishment forces that try to crush it. We've spoken with her about 2 previous novels in this vein, Kinship of Clover and On Hurricane Island. Her newest novel, Her Sister's Tattoo, continues the tradition. The book tells the story of 2 sisters whose lives are marked by the choices they make during an anti-war demonstration in 1968. Meerpol uses historical fiction to explore the personal dimension of activism and the thorny intersection of sibling loyalty and political beliefs. The great Marge Piercy, author of one of the books that formed my own political awareness, Woman on the Edge of Time, said, "Her Sister's Tattoo is an honest and riveting portrait of anti-war activists and the price individuals and families pay for their actions, no matter how just." Ellen Meerpol, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Now, this is your 3rd novel, is that right?
4th.
4th. You have been busy. This is Her Sister's Tattoo. And first, I want to ask you about the title, because the story revolves around 2 sisters, Rosa and Esther Levin, who each have the same tattoo on their left breast. I'm going to ask you what the tattoo is, but before even that, why her sister's tattoo and not the sister's tattoo or my sister's tattoo?
Because I try very hard in the novel to look at the events from both sisters' perspectives. I think that's one of the reasons it took such a long time to get this book right, because I wanted there to be a really clear way of looking at something that happened from two different perspectives. And her sister's tattoo could be spoken by either sister, referring to her sister. And so that's why I made that choice.
So what is that tattoo then they each have?
It's a small red star, which to them represents their commitment to making basic change in our society.
Tell us a little bit about Rosa and Esther. They're quite distinct personalities.
They are distinct personalities. They grow up in a family that's many generations of political activism. From their grandmother, who was a Menshevik in Russia, fighting against the Tsar, to their dad, who is a trade union organizer. So they grow up attending union rallies and civil rights protests. They grow up very active in Detroit, in the progressive community. And they're very close as young women, both working against the war in Vietnam and for women's liberation. Their personalities are quite different, and their situations are somewhat different. The older sister, Rosa, is headstrong and bossy and very, very sure of herself. The younger sister, Esther, is an artist who's trying to figure out how to make her art as a political statement. She also has an infant, a five-month-old daughter named Molly. And so on the day of the big demonstration, when the novel begins, she has left her baby with the babysitter and is torn, as mothers often are, between what's happening in the streets and what's happening to her baby at home.
And I'll say a little bit more about the relationship between them, because you know, Rosa's really the boss. And I was a little uncomfortable with how she treated her sister.
Yeah, Rosa is really bossy. And it's interesting because Esther has always believed, before the events of this book, that they could be twins, that they're so much alike and they understand each other so well. And it has not really bothered her until this point that Rosa was so bossy. I'm not sure she even really noticed it until she cared about something that meant a disagreement with her sister, and she cared about it deeply enough to really push back.
I think it's probably fair to say that you can't really talk much about the book without talking about the big demonstration that opens the book. So give us the context, the time, the place, and what happens.
Okay, so it's a hot August day, 1968. It's a big demonstration against the war in Vietnam. It's in Detroit. Rosa and Esther are marching with thousands of other people, old and young, white and black, in downtown Detroit. And they get to Kennedy Square, to the rally site, and they hear that a few blocks away, mounted police are beating up protesters who have sort of broken off into a bit of a side demonstration. They hear this, it worries them, and they go there to try to stop the violence. Instead, they end up taking an act which causes significant injury to a police officer. And that act that they take is what really propels the story. Rose is the one who really pushes it, but Esther agrees. And even though she has some qualms about it, she goes ahead because she believes in her sister and because she believes that it's the right thing to do. And that act is what initiates the conflict of the novel.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. We're talking with novelist Ellen Meeropol about her latest book, Her Sister's Tattoo. Right. I mean, what happens? The sisters are arrested. Molly has this five-month-old, and so she really faces a dilemma. She's offered a plea deal, but she has to testify against her sister. Talk a little bit about wrestling with these events and how you see them in terms of the struggle that Esther goes through and how Rosa responds to it.
Well, I think I should give some context to this conflict, and that is that the conflict between one sibling and another is something I've been more than a little obsessed with for many decades. My husband is the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were executed in 1953 for conspiracy to commit espionage. And the only testimony against his mother, Ethel, came from her brother, mm-hmm. from David Greenglass. He later admitted that he lied, that he perjured himself. And so this whole idea of sibling loyalty and sibling betrayal is something that has been an obsession of mine for a very long time. And I think when I started writing this, and I started writing it over 20 years ago, so I don't remember exactly what was in my mind at the beginning, but I know that Ethel and David, or Duvie, as she called her younger brother, who she adored, they were very close as kids, that was very much in my mind as something to explore. You know, in the years of writing the novel, Rosa and Esther are less and less over time like Ethel and David. In fact, they're really nothing like Ethel and David by the time the book was published, because Esther doesn't lie. She doesn't perjure herself. On the witness stand, she tells the truth as she sees it. But Rosa still understands that as a betrayal. And in fact, so does Esther. She understands it as a betrayal. I think we sort of expect our beloved family members to be loyal to us, even if it means lying. And that's one of the things that the book is trying to explore.
I'm just curious also, how did Ethel and Julius, you know, how did your husband and his brother see their uncle then? I mean, you know, was there ever a sense of, you know, what happened? Obviously, there must have been terrible betrayal. Was there ever a kind of rapprochement?
No, there never was. You know, when David admitted that he had lied, he did so on national TV on 60 Minutes. And he expressed no remorse, no regret, not even any shame. He pretty much said, well, I would do it again, because he was protecting his own wife and children. And so his sister was betrayed. There was never any, he never contacted the boys about what he had done. And, you know, I think that my husband grew up to adulthood being very grateful that his parents were Ethel and Julius, not David Greenglass.
So now back to this story in Her Sister's Tattoo. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the author Ellen Mirapol. Rosa's defense, talk about her defense of her actions. What does she say in court? What is her stance?
Well, her stance is that she is essentially fighting for the Vietnamese people. She wants to use the necessity defense, that her actions were necessary in order to prevent harm immediately to the protesters, but also she's doing this for the Vietnamese people. And that's the way she understands it. And really, that many of us felt that way in the streets in 1968 and that era. We felt that our government was wrong and the war was wrong, and we should do whatever we could to try to change those policies. And being young people without any real political power other than the streets, that's what we did. And that's the way Rosa understands it. And actually, Esther understands it that way too. They don't really disagree about the politics. It's just that once they become part of the court and so-called justice system, they're faced with impossible choices, you know, choices between their loyalty to each other, their loyalty to the truth as they understand it, and their commitment to social justice.
And a central question in the novel revolves around the cost of political activity in a number of different ways. I mean, the cost to family, the cost to, you know, one's conscience, but also the role of violence versus nonviolence. I think one character asks in the novel at a certain point, is fighting violence with violence okay? We are living in a time now where people, this is a question that's coming up in the streets a lot. I mean, people are mostly nonviolent, but there's been some violence against property that some people have defended as saying, you know, what's the greater harm, the harm to people that were protesting or the harm to the symbols of property that have been a part of an oppressive system? So I wonder if you could weigh in on that question.
Well, I think most of the violence at demonstrations has always been perpetrated by the police against the demonstrators. The overwhelming majority of the violence has gone in that direction. But, you know, political protests can have an element of violence. This isn't new. This has gone on for as long as there have been protests. But protests are still very powerful. So I try in the book to not tell readers what to take away about that issue. I think that there are very different ways of looking at it, and different readers will have a different bottom line when it comes to that. What I do want readers to understand through the story and through the characters is how incredibly important it is to stand up for what you believe in, no matter how you do it, no matter if you're in the street throwing things or much more likely in the street holding a sign and protesting, but that each of these choices can have real consequences, and can have some pretty significant risks. There are, however, even more risks for staying home, keeping our mouths shut, and letting things go on as they have.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Ellen Mirapol about her latest work of fiction, Her Sister's Tattoo. Right. I mean, you reference, some of the atrocities that the U.S., this is part of the anti-war movement, the demonstration, the anti-Vietnam War movement. some atrocities that you know, even though I was part of the movement, I didn't know about. For example, GIs throwing candy to Vietnamese children in such a way that they would be get run over by the military trucks behind them. Did this really happen?
Well, you know, a lot of those details I got through research into the Winter Soldier proceeds. You know, Winter Soldier was a project right after the war where returning GIs testified about what they had seen in Vietnam, what they had seen and what they had done. And that is where that detail came from. And like you, I didn't know a lot of those details before I started that research. But I was really blown away by them, and by the incredibly moving testimony of GIs who felt, many of them, just broken by what they had seen and sometimes what they had done.
John Kerry was part of that Winter Soldier investigation. He, you know, he asked, how do you tell a man to be the last, you know, the last man to die in a war, when he was arguing for, you know, it was time to end it yesterday?
Yeah.
Another thing that you reference in this novel, in Her Sister's Tattoo, Ellen Mirpole, is the COINTELPRO operation of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. It's involved in the plot here as well. Talk a little bit about that, and why did you decide to include that?
Well, you know, even though this is fiction, it was an opportunity to explore pieces of the history of that era. You know, it's more than 50 years ago now, and many young people don't know about COINTELPRO. They don't know about the atrocities of the war. And it also really fit nicely into the plot, because what Rosa was convicted of was much more than she actually did. COINTELPRO was an organized federal project of trying to discredit important left-wing groups. I believe it started and was primarily in the earliest days against the Black Panthers and other Black organizations that were really gaining some power and were very important in their communities. It also spread out to organizations like the National Lawyers Guild and to other anti-war organizations. And so having Rosa be caught up in there made sense in terms of being a plot device for why she would be convicted of more than, you know, throwing small apples at a mounted cop. Because that's what COINTELPRO did. They tried to use the legal system and other methods of discrediting protesters of all sorts.
Mm. Now, this story, you mentioned 50 years, it spans about 50 years. It goes on to talk about the children of the sisters, Molly and Emma. And it also ends with a demonstration. So I was really struck by that. And tell us about the demonstration it ends with. And then circling back to what's going on now with Black Lives Matter, you write about political issues. You've been doing that in your novels now for a while. You know, how do you feel about where we have come to? And do you feel that the demonstrations, the movement that is going on now, is the same as or has some differences to what has gone on before? And that's probably a lot. So just jump in wherever you want to.
Okay. Yeah. So the novel is really bookended by these two big demonstrations. 1968 against the war in Vietnam and 2003 against the invasion. And it is a That's done quite deliberately. One of the things I'm very interested in is how we as adults pass our values and experiences on to younger people, whether they be our own children and grandchildren or younger activists, and just the importance of that transmission of political and social values. And that's the reason why I decided to have Molly, that five-month-old grown-up, kind of take over a lot of the narration of the novel, because it really is all about how the past becomes the present and the future, and where we move now. I'm pretty hopeful, actually, about this political moment. I'm hopeful not only because of how incredibly successful the Black Lives Matter movement has been in reaching not only people of color, but of really reaching white people about fighting against our own racism, fighting against white supremacy in our world today. So I am hopeful. Do I think it's the same or different? I think there was incredible energy in the late 60s and early 70s, and there's incredible energy and will now to make change. The rulers have gotten smarter and nastier, and so one has to be somewhat cautious as well as hopeful. But I am hopeful that particularly young activists and activists of color will lead us to some significant change, not only in terms of the issues of racism and political power, but also in terms of the climate crisis, which we can't forget as we look at COVID and racism. There we have a sort of trinity of big things to fight against.
And to fight for.
And to fight for. Thank you. Yes.
Well, Ellen Meerepol, your latest novel, your fourth, is Her Sister's Tattoo. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about it.
Thank you, Francesca. I've enjoyed it a lot. Take care.
Ellen Meerepol is the author of three previous novels, about two of which we've spoken with her on this show, Kinship of Clover and On Hurricane Island. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to those interviews. Meerepol is also a founding member of Straw Dog Writers Guild, where she leads their social justice writing project. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.